She's in Furnow Hall on the lower level. As I was looking out the window this morning, I wondered if that professor, I can't remember his name, from the University of Maine, who argues that there's almost as much evidence that we're at the edge of a new period of glaciation as for the theory that there's going to be global warming. And it is a nice issue because it reflects so well the fact that some of these larger scale issues that would be extremely important for environmental policy, we're at a point where we don't have all the data and evidence that we would like. And then the question for us comes to be the question of how you make environmental policy in light of substantial uncertainty. How much sacrifice do you ask of people in light of the fact that the evidence seems so uneven? I haven't followed the global warming thing really closely. Some of you maybe have done that, but it does raise those kinds of questions. But this was on either public television or some other program the other night. There was mention of this professor from University of Maine who's suggesting a new ice age coming upon us. We're at a turning point in the course, in some respects. We're going to be contrasting the different ways of looking at nature, anthropocentric and biocentric and theocentric, although the last we won't deal with in detail insofar as quite a bit of the course has already focused on this. As I was working on my lecture notes, my thoughts turned to a comment I made during the review sessions that one of the discouraging thing about teaching ethics is there's not all that much evidence that it makes any difference. I'm very sorry to say that, but the evidence that standard courses in ethics really make that much difference is somewhat meager, and that is incidentally one of the reasons why I arrange the curriculum on a fairly broad scale, because I think the evidence is better, if anything, that we are motivated by great literature and drama and a different kind of vision of ourselves and the world in which we live. I was just reviewing a paper for one of my colleagues yesterday about how to work with children in the area of environmental ethics and encourage better attitudes towards the environment. And I must say the paper was somewhat gloomy in terms of empirical evidence that these different techniques make any difference. My sense of it is that the future, perhaps to a much greater extent than we realize, belongs with our children, and that the best way to deal with environmental ethics with children is in terms of developing what Kevin Bacher, one of my graduate students who's just finished, was a TA in this course for a couple of years, calls environmental character. But he argues the problem with developing environmental character is that it takes a very rich climate where you're free to use symbols and stories and myths and all the rest to shape a person's consciousness on this level. I didn't hear the speech the other night. If any of you did, you maybe could enlighten me on it, but I saw the newspaper accounts of the new president of the American Civil Liberties Union talking on the control of pornography. And at least from the newspaper accounts, and I'd be interested if any of you were there if the actual talk was different, it fascinated me that the whole discussion seemed to be on how pornography affects adults and particularly women, but the newspaper accounts didn't give any mention at all of how it might affect children. And it is fascinating to me for this reason that some of the classical theorists in free speech and various liberties that we possess, such as John Stuart Mill, argued that these liberties are for people in the maturity of their faculties. And one of the things that I find most troubling as we look about the into the future in terms of environmental ethics is that our children are not only exposed to so much violence and gratuitous sexuality, but that so very, very much of what they're exposed to is really counter-environmental. It's based very, very much on self-interest, on consumption, on appealing to people's insecurities and touting various products and so on as the answer to these problems. And in that kind of a climate, it does seem to me that it's just extraordinarily difficult to inculcate the kind of values that I think over the long run would help us deal better with the environment. Perhaps the kind of values that people like Wendell Berry are talking about in his book, The Unsettling of America. I saw a piece just a couple of days ago, and I may actually copy it as an extra article. Incidentally, be sure you get the piece on deep ecology out in the hall. It's a freebie because of my own procrastination. It should have been in the packet, but I didn't pick it out in time. But this piece I saw from the magazine Christianity Today made a fascinating point, which I've sort of thought of. Berry sort of talks about it in The Unsettling of America, in the chapter The Body and the Earth, and I've even partly lectured on it, but this article made it much, much more explicit, arguing that in a way a market society, a capitalist society that wants people to consume a lot of products, our well-being to a certain extent depends on keeping the economy going, that this society or at least the business interests in this society, would seem to have a fairly strong stake in not promoting abstinence and chastity for children and young people. And the argument here is that the sexual instinct is one of the most powerful instincts that we have, and if you are able to control that with some degree of success, that there probably is a fairly large spillover effect to other desires that you have, such as for all this infinite variety of products, and you probably will more easily be able to say no because you will have learned to discipline yourself in one of the areas where your desires and instincts are the strongest. But if you do not learn discipline in that area, so the author was arguing, it's probably going to be a lot harder to resist advertising across the board. That's a fascinating argument. I actually think that's correct. I don't know how one would prove it, but it does seem to me that the market has some interest in constantly keeping us in a state where we feel good about satisfying our desires and where we feel bad about thwarting them in any way. Worth thinking about, and if that's the case, then we may be in even worse shape than I thought, because so much of our popular culture today and the focus on sexual liberation and so much of the sex education and so on has pretty much the attitude that you should be very careful in thwarting these desires. It might harm you psychologically and all the rest. I don't know, but I might Xerox that and pass it out. The other thought, as I was beginning to put together ideas on anthropocentrism, was the fact that I, the item that I mentioned in some of the review sessions, namely, that it increasingly appears to me that a fair part of our self-righteous anger against DuPont or Monsanto or whomever it may be, those awful people in Washington or those awful people on Wall Street or whatever, it seems to me that a fair part of this anger which often is very self-righteous, is related to the fact that at a fairly deep level, we sense these ambiguities and sense the fact that there is a huge discrepancy between our actions and our talk. In one or two of the review sessions, I mentioned the fact that we live in a world where any one of us over the next 12 months probably could prevent two or three children in Africa or other parts of the world from having lifelong brain damage because of protein deficiency. Maybe $100 would do that. That's something that any one of us could easily do. Some of you are doing it. And that's a very, very unnerving, unsettling reality. The same with the environment. Put in the hands of the right groups, enough $100 contributions could do a lot towards saving the rainforests and other things of that sort. And I think part of the anger is that we really are angry at ourselves because we understand these tensions, we understand these contradictions, and we really, really don't know quite what to do with them. I just mentioned in passing before the feelings of uneasiness I had 7 or 8 years ago when I built a new house. And even though I could rationalize some of the cost and size of the house on the basis of the fact that the main floor was designed around my wife's music teaching, she was still able to teach at that time and had 30 or 40 students, and we wanted a living room, for instance, large enough that they could all meet together for small recitals and et cetera, et cetera. Nonetheless, after the house was all finished, in fact, didn't even take that long. As soon as I saw the outline of the foundation, I had this horrible, horrible feeling. What have I done? It's as if I had lost my innocence environmentally, and that it would be a lot more difficult to teach a course in environmental ethics because here was this house, large, fairly expensive, sitting there, sort of laughing at me and my pretensions. And I think that's the human predicament. And if nothing else, I would hope that this course would soften some of our self-righteous anger against those people with whom we disagree. Not saying we should not fight for specific environmental issues and causes, but I think the world in which we live makes it difficult to do that with too much self-righteousness because we're so painfully aware of those contradictions in ourselves. That's an interesting challenge, incidentally. The next time you catch yourself being indignant at the folly and stupidity of others, challenge yourself to set aside $100 over the next 12 months. Give you a nice feeling to know that you've prevented two or three children from lifelong brain damage. At least I would hope it would. That's also one of the disadvantages of television and global communications, is we can't escape these realities anymore. Anthropocentrism. We have to distinguish, I would suggest, between human thinking and human self-centeredness. All our thinking is human thinking, unless one perhaps has some concept of divine revelation where humans think the thoughts of God after him. But in ordinary circumstances, all of our thinking is human thinking, and it is personal thinking. Michael Polanyi, in his book, that's P-O-L-A-N-Y-I, in his book Personal Knowledge, suggests that the old dichotomy between subject and object has broken down, and that all of our thinking, not only about values and morality, but even about science, takes the form that I suggested in an earlier class. I believe X judgment is warranted. I believe there are good reasons for believing why. That all of our thinking in science or the humanities takes the form of a personal commitment to the truth of various propositions, theories, ideas, and so on. Now, we can't escape this aspect of our human predicament. We're inextricably tied to particularity, to history, to the specific circumstances in which we live and think. But it does seem to me clearly that at least to some degree we can escape self-centeredness. This is what Iris Murdoch is talking about in the concept of unselfing, Niebuhr in the concept of the shattering of the self, St. Paul in the concept of being crucified with Christ, and so on. That the fact that we inevitably operate from the center of ourselves, how else could we be conscious and so on? We can't, in that sense, totally escape ourselves, even though we can be, to some degree, self-reflexive. But that is not getting out of ourselves. It's simply one part of the self thinking about the rest. We can't escape that, but we can, to some degree, escape the self-centeredness. Now, one of the reasons that we chose Joseph Sachs's book, Mountains Without Handrails, besides the fact that it's just a delightful book, it's well written, it reads nicely, and has some stimulating ideas, is I wanted to dispel some of the myths about anthropocentrism. Sachs clearly is an anthropocentrist in his view of nature. I'm not an anthropocentrist. I think it's a mistaken position. But I wanted to assign a book which makes a very persuasive case for anthropocentrism. Because if you read the book carefully, he is not making the argument that we ought to do X, Y, and Z for the sake of nature. He's really making the argument that we ought to do these things because it will make our lives as human beings better. And he's making certain distinctions. Vicki, nice to see you arrive safely. Vicki drives down from Syracuse, and whenever I think of you people coming from distances, I worry about whether you're going to get here or not. Hi. Good. And I think that is very important to see that even if you reject the position of anthropocentrism, don't reject a caricature. It's possible to be anthropocentric, which again, I remind you, I'm not in my own thinking, or at least try not to be, and still have a very high regard for nature and for how we ought to treat nature. There are still deeper questions that I will raise as we go along, because I do reject the position, but it's a powerful position. It is not the position that's seen so often in the writings of some environmentalists and deep ecologists and others. It can be a fairly sophisticated position. To the surprise of some of you, at least, I think I could substantiate the claim that Aldo Leopold is to a large degree anthropocentric. That may indeed seem surprising, but I think if you read the entire corpus of his writings, there's at least as much evidence that he is thinking in terms of the ultimate well-being of humanity as well as of nature. He also has, obviously, high regard for nature. Sachs makes many very fine points. I trust that you will go over some of these in section. I'm a little skeptical of some of what looks like elitism to me. We used to read the book in the course, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. How many of you ever read the book? It's a fascinating book and shows that one can have a very high regard and a feeling of considerable fulfillment in a machine. And in the maintenance of the machine and in understanding the machine. I think that's basically correct. I think there's a good deal of snobbishness on the part of many academics about automobiles, and also a good deal of hypocrisy. I think actually most of us like automobiles a great deal. Few of us choose to live without them, but we go through the ritual disclaimers of how bad these things are, and indeed they are bad in some respects in terms of what they've done to the environment. But my view is that we cannot make progress over the long run if we take a Luddite attitude, that is a fundamentally anti-technological attitude towards science, technology, engineering, and so on. To me, something as simple as a needle-nose pliers that is well-designed is in some senses a genuine work of art. I love the feeling of a good tool in my hand. I had to learn how to be a machinist as part of the way of paying my way through college and grad school. Learned how to run a milling machine and a lathe and a shaper and drill presses and all kinds of other machines. And metal, I think, overall is not as much fun to work with as wood. I have more pleasure working with wood, although unfortunately I don't know how to use the tools nearly as well. But there's great pleasure if you talk with a craftsperson. There's great pleasure in using tools well and in having fine tools. I can think of few things that give me more aesthetic pleasure than the Golden Gate Bridge. It is an incredible work of art. Just fits right in the right place. In my view, it enhances the total scene, and I think we would be poorer without it. So I detect some degree of elitism in this book that I both resonate with in part and also question in part. I think Sachs is basically correct that our national parks should not mainly or even substantially be used for off-road vehicles and motorcycles and the rest. I think that that can be done in areas that are not as ecologically sensitive or as aesthetically attractive as places like Yosemite Valley and many parts of Yellowstone and so on. On the other hand, I'm not nearly as negative as he is about those activities per se. I don't ride a motorcycle. I'm slightly terrified of them most of the time. But I do have enormous appreciation of how a well-designed car works. And I find it very pleasurable to drive a car if I have the time to drive very leisurely, motoring through parts of the Appalachians and parts of the West. I can think of experiences in Europe and so on that were thoroughly pleasurable. So I'm not altogether negative by any means towards machines and so on. Now, where Sachs, I think, raises the correct point is where should these activities be done? And he doesn't raise the point, but I would raise the point that, and here I think he's essentially correct, that if the meaning of the national parks is essentially to satisfy human desires as over against, in some sense, to make us better human beings, to develop character and make us, in some sense, better, stronger human beings, then it seems to me very doubtful that the federal government or the state government should run parks at all. Because I think there's ample evidence that the market is substantially more sensitive to satisfying human desires than our federal or state bureaucracies. So to that degree, I think Sachs is essentially correct that the parks ought to have some relationship to making us better people, and thus we ought to look very carefully at what we do in the parks. Otherwise, let's sell them all. sell them to Disney World and other entrepreneurs and let them satisfy our desires. Why should government be involved at all if it's just a matter of satisfying desires and if, as in the theory of liberal neutrality, all desires are roughly equal? Why should government be involved? This is the same question, incidentally, that we would have in terms of things like museums or any subsidy of symphony performances or opera and so on. If this is simply a matter of desire, then it seems to me that it becomes extremely difficult to argue that the desires of the one group are better than the other, unless you essentially abandon the position of liberal neutrality, which I do, incidentally. I don't think the position ultimately makes sense. But at least for those who want to stay within that framework, it makes it extremely difficult. Now, Sachs is also very strong in this book on his argument that the conservationist and the preservationist are essentially prophets for a new religion. I think this point is very well made, that a great deal of the animus, a great deal of the drive in conservation work, preservation work, is not purely pragmatic. It's that the conservationist deeply wants us to think correctly, to have the right moral sentiments, to be people who see the truth. And there are several passages in the book that make this point very, very persuasively, that we're really being invited to see ourselves and the world in which we live in a very different way. Kevin Bacher just finished his master's thesis on environmental education, and when you read some of the curricula that he looks at, this is very, very evident. The children are really being invited to shed their old worldviews, their old ways of thinking about themselves in the world, and to convert to a new worldview. Now, that's not altogether bad. I think that to some degree that's exactly right. That's what's needed. But I think that Sachs is helpful in pointing out what's going on, that this is not just a transfer of information. This is a kind of religious conversion. And that raises very, very serious questions, which we're going to look at a little later in the course, regarding the role of the state in converting us. We may want to talk about that just a little bit. Okay, we need to keep these three positions clearly in mind, but it would be a mistake to think of anthropocentrism and biocentrism and theocentrism as quite discrete, separate positions. They overlap to a great degree. So that a large part of what the biocentric thinks about nature may be shared by the theocentric or the anthropocentrist. And that's understandable. This goes back to the point that C.S. Lewis makes, that a very large part of the whole area of morality and ethics consists of things we agree on, but those aren't the things we talk about. We're usually aware of our differences and spend relatively little time talking about areas of agreement. But it's important to recognize those areas of agreement, because in some ways the overlap among these three positions, between these positions, is at least as significant as the differences. And thus I think also it becomes counterproductive for environmentalism as a whole if there is too much infighting among these various groups. And that's also a reason why I wanted you to read Sachs, because Sachs presents a very persuasive position. And I think some of you, even if you think of yourself ultimately as biocentrics, could find yourself agreeing with a very large part of what he says. Anthropocentrists do not need to despise nature. They can be extremely sensitive to the value of nature, to its inherent or intrinsic value. To be sure, there are differences. In an area like animal rights, an anthropocentrist probably would be more likely to use animals for medical research, to eat animals, to use them in other ways. But still, the anthropocentrist might have very strong beliefs that animals should be protected both for their own sake and for the sake of human beings. An anthropocentrist would likely, almost by definition, see human beings as more valuable than animals or other parts of nature, but would not in any sense need to despise animals or treat other parts of nature, including animals, with out care and respect. I'm hoping that somewhat later in the semester, Michal, that you'll give us a class sharing what you did the other night. There were only a few of you who showed up at Michal Smart's lecture on Jewish environmental ethics, and I've asked her if she would share some of those ideas with us in class. So I'll just rather gingerly go over the next section in my notes, which was to talk a little bit about some of the alleged conflict between Christianity and Judaism on the one hand and environmental sensitivity on the other hand. The classic article here was Lynn White's article in Science magazine back in 1967, where he talks about the ecological roots of our environmental crisis. And the article is referred to again and again in the literature and makes what appear to me some reasonable points, but overall I think is overstated. And I hope, Michal, you'll be able to unpack some of that for us. He basically suggests that Christianity bears a huge amount of guilt for the shape we're in today environmentally, because Christianity, he argues, provided much of the intellectual context for this sense of domination and control and power vis-a-vis the environment. He goes back to the Genesis text that human beings are commanded to multiply and subdue the earth and exercise dominion over it. The problem with the Lynn White thesis is that I think it only touches on part of the reality, because human beings were also commanded to be stewards, to take care of the earth, and that, Michal, is where I think you could help us a good deal by filling in a lot of those details. There's a very rich amount of material in the Jewish scriptures, in Talmud, and elsewhere that suggests a fairly different view of the attitude of Judaism towards the environment and also of Christianity. Where I think Lynn White is correct is that it does seem to me historically that the combination of what the Ionian Greek philosophers did in the 5th, 6th centuries before the Christian era, and what the Jews did in their attitudes towards time and history, set the stage for the development of modern science. That is, the Ionian Greek philosophers argued that everything has an arche, a beginning, a cause, and tried to view this not any longer mainly in terms of the activities of the gods and in terms of various mythological motifs, but tried to view these realities in terms of causes that we would think of as physical or that could be dealt with by science, air, fire, water, and so on. And the Greeks, through Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, developed the intellectual tools, it seems to me, that made it possible later to do science, and also some of the mathematical tools. We also look back to the Arab world for some of these. On the other hand, it was the Jews who most persuasively put forward a view of history where history is not just the ephemeral, somewhat shadowy reflection of what is ultimately real, the realm of the forms or ideas, but history is where the action really takes place. History is not cyclical, but linear. Things actually move through time and may move in a purposive direction. It seems to me that the combination of the intellectual tools of the Greeks and the particular view of history and also the view of providence, that history is ordered by God, it's not chaotic, this sets the tools, or the stage, I should say, for the development of modern science and technology. That much, I think, is clear, that it is not accidental that although you had some very important developments, for instance, in China, in the realm of science and technology, that it never took off in quite the way that it did in the Western world. Now, again, and I hope maybe, Michal, you could develop some of that in your lecture, it does seem to me that in our own age, we are powerfully aware of how dangerous it is to separate ourselves too far from nature. We're powerfully aware of our abuse of nature, of the fact that we have ignored natural cycles, and according to some of the ecofeminists, we've ignored our somatic existence, our sexuality, our emotionality, and all of this. And we see some of those dangers. On the other side, it seems to me that we should not underestimate what a monumental shift in human consciousness it was when among the ancient Israelites and among the Ionian Greek philosophers there was a certain demythologizing or desacralizing of nature. I've touched on this just briefly before. That the very possibility of studying and understanding nature as we do in modern science, I think, requires a certain psychological distance from nature. As long as every stick and stone and tree and river and mountain and animal has a spirit, it's almost like dissecting your grandmother to study nature too closely. That's not a very happy analogy. But I think it's psychologically problematic because all of these creatures, animate and inanimate, you might say, are your brothers and sisters, or at least distant cousins. And there certainly were advantages to that, in that I think it made it less likely in some way psychologically that we would violate them. But on the other hand, I think it also made it less likely that we would develop much of modern culture as we know it. That a certain distancing of ourselves from nature, in my judgment, is part of what makes it possible for culture to flourish, including modern science. So that I would suggest when we're too hard on the Jewish and Christian traditions, we should remember that. Now, these comments about Lynn White don't apply just to anthropocentrism, although that's the term that he uses. It applies to a certain extent across the board. What I'm suggesting, in other words, is that these large-scale revolutions that took place, particularly the desacralizing or demythologizing of nature, to be sure were dangerous, but they were also extraordinarily liberating. I see this as somewhat analogous to what happened with the rise of English liberalism, Locke, Hume, Adam Smith, and so on. I think that the tendency in English liberalism to equate rational behavior with self-interested behavior in the long run has proven to be a very dangerous tendency. On the other hand, historically, it seems to me one can recognize that this provided the means for liberation of a certain sort from feudal domination, from a strongly hierarchical society, from a society where it was virtually impossible to shift your role very much. So that English liberal thinking and, in other respects, the Enlightenment unleashed enormous creativity in the Western world. But I think today we see some very real liabilities, because it's becoming increasingly clear to us that the kind of anthropocentrism or self-centeredness that argues essentially that rational behavior is self-interested behavior, and then which later develops into the belief that all of our desires in a certain sense are equal, or at least that liberal government cannot distinguish between them, I think those become fairly dangerous beliefs in the modern world. Just one other set of comments that I find fascinating here, as I was thinking about the earlier lecture on C.S. Lewis, where I talked about his book, The Abolition of Man. I find one of the more fascinating issues, the whole question that we are very concerned about what nature is, and about not changing nature beyond recognition. We're very concerned about nature preservation. Some of us are rather frightened about the possibility of genetic manipulation. We tend to be very, very conservative about nature. Let's not lose species. Let's not force a kind of artificial overlay upon nature. But what puzzles me a great deal is that this concern takes place during a period in history where many scholars, perhaps the majority of scholars in the humanities today, are very, very skeptical as to whether there is any such thing as human nature. On the one hand, we ought to be very conservative and very cautious in changing our natural environment, but the same people in many cases arguing that there is no such thing as human nature. We are whatever we make ourselves, and that seems puzzling to me. If we're so willing to see ourselves as not possessing any essence or true nature, so to speak, why are we so concerned about making changes in nature outside of ourselves? And I think we're wrestling today with some very, very tough questions in this respect. I think the ecofeminists are challenging us to think about this. Is it not true, they're arguing, some of them, Gilligan and Plumwood and others, that male and female is quite different in some ways, and that to insist that there is no nature involved here, that human beings are whatever we make them to be, and that all of the differences between male and female are environmental, are culturally induced, that seems odd to me. I think we're going to be raising still for many, many years questions about whether abortion is natural, whether it is consonant with human nature. And I'm not here making a judgment one way or another at this point whether society should permit abortion or not, but my guess is that we're going to find it hugely contradictory of human nature. My guess is that as we become more sophisticated in understanding who we are in the whole reproductive process and birth and so on, that we're going to be rather horrified someday at the way we have tended to think of abortion as roughly on the level of having your appendix removed or something. Or I think we're going to be raising some very tough questions about child nurture. I think we're going to look back on this period of surrogate child care with some horror, and are going to recognize that maybe we didn't have all the answers right. Is it natural? Is it going to be acceptable for us to redesign ourselves genetically? Is hunting any less natural or appropriate for human beings than predation is for other species? Now, what I'm getting at here is that this puzzling issue that we're very willing to be ultra-competitive, some, about external nature and not very conservative about human nature. And oddly, many of the people who are more conservative about human nature don't have many qualms about changing, sometimes drastically, external nature. I don't know that there's any easy response to that, except I'm puzzled by it, because why would we not want something more like a preservation movement in terms of who we are? Is it true that we are simply whatever we make of ourselves, and that there are no genetic structural limits to for what it means to be a human being? I think that position is hugely mistaken, but I ask the question, what kind of behavior is appropriate for us as human beings? And I guess what I'm getting at, and I don't have any good answers for this, is that I have a kind of intimation or intuition that a whole range of human behaviors, we've talked about chastity, and Barry talks about our marriages and fidelity and so on, I'm rather suspicious that we're going to find that these are much more closely related to how we deal with external nature than up till now we have realized. And that it's going to be a kind of package deal. And that we are going to have to really rethink who we are if we're going to make progress towards external nature. Now, these comments to some extent overlap biocentrism and theocentrism. They really apply to all three. But I leave that with you not so much as an answer as I do as a question. I was utterly fascinated, as I suggested, with this article that put forward the thesis that the market system really needs young people who who don't learn how to control their sexual desires. Fascinating thesis. If it's right, it might suggest that the way we come to peace with nature is going to be much more indirect and have much more to do with ourselves than we thought. I throw these out for your discussion. I don't know what to these questions are, but they're very, very interesting questions. And if I can judge from my own experience at least, the difficulty of living an environmentally consistent life is very great. And it's also much harder to be a hypocrite, or much easier to be a hypocrite. In many areas we can fake it, but mostly when it comes to consumption patterns and the houses we live in and the cars we drive, these are fairly public. And I think that some of this explains the uneasiness, it explains some of the anger. I'm fairly convinced that a fair part of the anger is really anger directed at ourselves, but it's much easier to project it out towards other people than to admit our own complicity in the exploitation of nature and of other people. This doesn't resolve much, but maybe that's okay. I really wanted to give you a little slice of where my thinking is at this point and then see where that eventually takes us. Again, I would announce that your exams are with my secretary. Jim or Carl, if you actually get over to Furno before the sections, take some of them with you. I would have liked to have brought them this morning, but I forgot them. Thank you.